now and then, we get economic data that inspires a collective, wait, what? Among the people who watch this stuff. And that's pretty much the reaction to this month's jobs report, which came out on Friday. Only 38,000 jobs created in May, but the lowest unemployment rate since November of 2007. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. It's not a great report. The percentage of Americans who are working shrank, but what we won't know for a while is whether this is a trend or a blip. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. It's an election year, of course. Europe is in the middle of figuring out whether it really wants to stay together. And global growth feels tenuous. This week, we're going both big picture and small bore. From those global economic questions to how you keep a toddler happy on an airplane on your summer vacation. As always, come share your stories with us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to kick things off the way we normally do by borrowing a couple of words from the world of finance and asking our panelists to go long and short, that is, bet on or against some topics in the world of news and business. And this week, we have Jonathan Capehart, an opinion writer at The Washington Post and contributor at MSNBC, and Marketplace's own Tracy Samuelson. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Thanks very much.
All right, Jonathan, you're the guest. This is your first time. I'm going to let you give us your long.
I'm going long on the Democratic campaign.
Oh, dear God.
For president. Yes. No matter what happens on Tuesday, even if Hillary Clinton clinches the nomination with the New Jersey primary and goes on to wallop Senator Bernie Sanders in California, Senator Sanders is going to keep going. He still has a ton of money and lots of enthusiasm to keep going all the way to the convention. It ain't over until they get to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Is this about money or is this the principle of the thing?
I think it's both money and principle on Senator Sanders' part. I mean, this is a guy who can we speak plainly here? He's not a Democrat. And so he describes himself as a Democratic socialist who decided to run for president under the Democratic Party banner because that's the way he would get attention. So he has no loyalty to the Democratic Party. So you take that plus the fact that he is sitting on top of millions of dollars, tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, the money is enabling the principles, right?
Like, yep.
He is saying he wants to affect the party platform.
Ish.
And the money is just a way for him to do that.
All right, Trace, I want to flip to year long because I feel like it's the opposite of America. So go ahead.
I am long also in terms of length, distance, if you will. The tunnel that opened this week in Switzerland, a $12 billion project, 17 years it took to complete this tunnel. And yet that was actually on time and on budget. So the Swiss have done a major infrastructure project and completed it successfully.
In a very Swiss way. I feel like if this was something that was happening in the United States, first of all, we'd fight over it over like 6 or 7 years and then it probably wouldn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. And the tunnel somehow also became, you know, a symbol of European unity at a time when, you know, walls are being discussed. It was everything all at once.
As you were talking about this and marveling at the Swiss, there in New York, the remake of Penn Station has been going on for just about the same amount of time.
Not only that, but we've been building a Second Avenue subway tunnel, which has taken, well,
lifetimes.
Not lifetimes, but it is behind schedule.
Jonathan, I want to kick it to your short because I'm on this team with you.
Yeah, so I'm going short on original movies. And, you know, we don't have them anymore. They're all what they're called, these tentpole type franchises. So it's all about the sequel and the remake and action figures and comic book figures. I just watched Deadpool on my flight back from Italy. It was hilarious. And yet what we're seeing is those types of movies are taking over Hollywood and that all the original movies are heading to cable.
Well, yeah, all those things have a built-in audience. So I think if you're laying out hundreds of millions of dollars to make the thing, you know, it's almost a guaranteed return on investment. You know that there is an audience built in.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, the experience of going to the theater can be a really nice experience to go to the theater, and yet you look up and see what's playing. Most of my movie watching these days does happen on my laptop.
All right, Tracy, you get to take us out with a short.
Okay, my short is a little bit of a downer. I apologize in advance. So we have yet another report, economic outlook this week from the OECD based in Paris, which said growth in 2016 is going to be basically flat, same levels as 2015. But kind of more depressing, they said we're stuck in this slow growth trap, that we're at a point where the slow growth kind of begets slow growth. What I am short is, so they've said that the way out of this trap is basically for governments to spend. And so I'm not short that idea. I'm short the likelihood of that happening. We've heard sort of similar refrains from the IMF about warnings about slow growth, you know, the need for action from policymakers. The central
banks. You're shorting Keynesianism.
No, I'm not shorting Keynesianism. What I'm shorting is not at all the idea that it should happen. It's just I'm short the execution.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Jonathan? I mean, you're in Washington. You follow politics. It seems to me like we do get these kind of policy prescriptions from places like the IMF, the OECD, and yet politicians go, meh.
There's a strange thing. There's either the lack of political will to make the tough decisions that would get things in imbalance or in line, or there is a willful ignorance of the impact of some of the prescriptions. We've got huge problems here in Washington, in our own backyard, with our own finances, that to ask anyone in Congress what they think about the global economy and what global institutions have to say about it, I mean, you might as well just ask the person next to you where's the nearest unicorn.
Jonathan Capehart from The Washington Post and MSNBC, Tracy Samuelson here at Marketplace. Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks.
Last weekend, of course, was Memorial Day weekend, which traditionally kicks off the summer travel season. As someone who used to cover transportation, I have done that thing where you stand in an airport with a TV crew and watch the chaos. We decided, though, to talk to you, not at you, and have a conversation about how you pull off successfully traveling with kids. And our Facebook page basically blew up with comments. Jen Longson's tip, don't be afraid to ask for help.
People tend to shut down and feel like they need to handle everything and that they're on their own. People want to help you. They want to help, but they don't feel like they can reach out to help you. It's sort of insulting, maybe, possibly insulting to a mom to say, well, maybe you can't handle this. But as a mom, I just go, you know, it's okay to not be able to handle it. Just ask for help. Kids are crazy. Like, you know, you do what you can and ask for help when you need it.
Have you had that work particularly well? You wrote us about a plane trip, I think, while you were pregnant with your second?
Yeah, I was 6 months pregnant with my son, and I had a daughter. My daughter she's turning 3, so she was turning 2, actually, at the time, because it was that week we were going up to Seattle. On our way back, though, I had a car seat with me for her to ride in the plane, and I have a rolling luggage, and I had her strapped to my back on a baby carrier, and I'm 6 months pregnant, and I go up to the desk, and I'm like, can I load early? Like, I'm just overwhelmed with stuff. And he's like, it's a really packed flight. Did you get early boarding passes? And there was a couple that was standing right next to the front gate, and they had early boarding passes, and they said, oh, she's part of our group. And it was not a problem. People were happy to help me out.
And while parking an iPad in front of your kid's face is a fairly popular solution, Graham Petersburg is actually not a fan.
We find it to be passive, and we like when our kids are engaged when we're traveling. If you have a book open and somebody says, look up and look at this, you don't have headphones on and you're not scrambling to hit pause, you look up. We're interacting, and we're also listening to audiobooks, and all as a family.
Do you tend to travel by car, by plane? How do you do it?
Probably half and half.
I know that your older child is 6. Boy or girl?
Boy. Both boys.
Does he ever get, you know, because he's old enough, does he ever get sort of like aware of what other kids are up to and say to you like, Dad, I want to play a video game on the plane?
Not at all. The reason that works is because it's not something that is part of their life, so they don't miss it. Both my kids go to Waldorf School in Minneapolis, which is also screen-free.
I'm going to flip this around a little bit. So I don't have kids, and occasionally you will encounter on an airplane a grumpy person like me who, for whatever reason, didn't get enough sleep or what have you, and is not the most tolerant traveler around children. Are there things that you say or do in public, either to strangers or to your kids, to kind of ease the tension in those situations?
Yeah, I try to make jokes to people like that. Which people usually are pretty receptive to and actually more sympathetic. I know there are grumpy people. And to be honest, I interact with other parents more when I see a grumpy person interact with another family who's having a challenge on a flight where a kid is crying. And I just say, hey, remember, you know, just hang in there. You're doing your best. We all know that. And, you know, I also make a joke like, you know, that guy's a total... expletive.
And, you know, expletives also pop up when the best laid plans of traveling parents go awry, which is what Jerry Chang found out on his flight to Maui this week.
About halfway through the flight, my youngest one, who I was holding, woke up and started screaming his head off. He was crying for about 5 to 10 minutes. I held him, and all of a sudden, he just starts vomiting everything he had in his stomach, and it soaked my sweatshirt. The rules sort of go out the window. We try to give them as much leeway as possible just to make them comfortable. We download all the movies. We give them all the sweet snacks, everything. All that planning, it's all great, but you have to realize that everything's out of your control. You know, you might end up with a soaked T-shirt.
We got so many great responses to this question that we want to keep this conversation going for next week, but with a twist. Traveling with kids can also be really expensive. So are there ways you try to save money when you do it? Tell us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or you can leave us a message by calling 1-800-648-5114. And yes, your voice might be used on the air. Payday lending has long filled a very specific niche in our financial system, usually for people with low incomes or no bank account. They can borrow against their paychecks, often at exorbitant rates. This week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau unveiled a new set of regulations meant to drastically change payday lending. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been covering this and joins me now. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Lizzie.
Explain what these rules say.
It's a lot of stuff. I mean, it's a 1,300-page proposed ruling, so there's a lot in there. But here's the big thing. Basically, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is saying if you want to give these super high-interest loans, you have to make sure that people will actually have the ability to pay them back. They want these companies, these payday lenders, title loan lenders, anybody who does these high-interest installment loans, anything like that, you're supposed to check and make sure that after people pay back their bill, the interest on top of it, that they still have money to live.
So, I mean, that seems pretty basic. Do consumer advocates think this is likely to help people who take out these loans?
So it's a mix. Some consumer activists are just super grateful that anything has been done because payday loans really affect the poor communities the most, communities of color, and can be really detrimental to people because people will get caught up in this cycle of getting another payday loan to pay back their previous payday loan and accruing interest, and it just goes nuts. And so a lot of consumer advocates and groups that support minority and poor communities are saying at least this is something. This ability to repay is an important thing to have. However, others are saying, well, look, there's still going to be charging this crazy high interest rate. They just have to do more paperwork in order to get these loans out to people to charge them crazy high interest rates. And therefore, that's going to make these loans even more expensive. And the other side of it is one advocate to whom I spoke was saying, this is great, but It's going to make it so these payday lenders no longer have an incentive to even give these loans because it's going to cost them so much. And the CFPB didn't provide any alternatives. So where are people going to go?
Well, that's sort of the next question that I have here is, you know, most things that are regulations have some kind of unintended consequence. And in this one, I guess it raises the question of access to credit.
Exactly. And I was speaking to several people who work with banks and payday lenders, and they're saying these regulations as proposed are going to make it impossible for smaller payday lenders to even exist. It's just going to be too expensive. It's not going to be worth it to them. They're going to go out of business. The other thing is that larger banks are really complaining because they were hoping to see in these regulations some sort of opening to make it easier for the bigger banks to offer these small dollar loans. But that's not in these proposed rules. So they're pushing to say, hey, at least give us a space so that we can do this in a profitable way because we can lower the cost. That said, consumer advocates are saying we shouldn't have these high interest small dollar loans at all to begin with. The proposal is just a proposal. The CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, is taking comments until September the 14th.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Washington. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Brazil a fair amount on this show because it's in an ongoing economic and political crisis. And now, add to that, hosting the Summer Olympics. They're set to open in just a couple months. This week, Amnesty International in Brazil called on Rio de Janeiro's government to end what it called systemic use of force in the slums or favelas around the city. The government has been clearing some residents out of them prior to the Games. From our partners at the BBC, reporter John Bithrie went to visit one such community called Vila Autodromo.
We've come just a few minutes from the Olympic Park to yet another construction site and yet more feverish activity. Here, two roads are being widened and a new rapid transit busway is being put in. But the land alongside bears the scars of a battle between Rio's authorities and the residents of a small community which resisted the demolition of their homes to make way for the Olympics. Now, most of the 600 houses here have been knocked down, just rubble and trenches remain. A red crucifix marks the spot where one house stood. A few residents are still here, and I'm going to meet one of them inside the peach-coloured church, which still stands and provides welcome relief from the dusty air and construction noise outside. Sandra Maria de Souza, a mother of four, has lived in Vila Autodromo for more than 25 years. She told me how life changed once the land was earmarked for development.
It was so hard because we suffered so much psychological pressure, so many threats, as well as violence. Houses were demolished without warning. We suffered power cuts. We stayed here sometimes 1-2 days without water, without electricity. Lighting poles were removed from the street, leaving the street in darkness. The residents had to fix everything. Some made deals and others were forced to leave, but no one wanted to go. And now we are only 20 families.
Por isso nós chegamos a esse final com apenas 20 famílias.
Do you think that the Olympic Games is a higher priority for Rio and the authorities here than for many of its residents, like you?
Em todos os países por onde a Olimpíada passou, ela removeu.
In all countries where the Olympics has been hosted, whole communities have been removed. It's an event that does not include the poor people. Vila Autódromo will go down in history as the first community to resist the Olympic removal process. The Olympic Games was the perfect excuse to remove Vila Autódromo, which City Hall have been trying to remove for almost 30 years. The Olympic Games has provided the excuse and the money to remove Vila Autódromo.
Well, I'm having a walk round this site with Janaína Pinto, who is a research assistant in urban planning at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. Janaína, what has gone on here? I mean, this has had a major impact on this community, hasn't it?
Actually, what happened here was a battle between two conceptions of city. On one side, you have people believing that a city is just an assemblage of individuals. And on the other side, you have people struggling to establish some of their rights preserved. And trying to talk about a society and trying to talk about politics in a public way, not only in a way to serve the economics of every aspect of this Olympics.
The authorities would say, we needed to expand these roads. We're holding the Olympics. There are always going to be losers. What would your response be to that?
And then I would have to go back a little, because this struggle around this land has been on and on for over 50 years now. Because in the 70s, there was a boom here, a real estate speculation boom. And in the 90s, a left-wing politician that was a governor of the Rio de Janeiro state, Leonel Brizola, granted the use concession to these families that lived here. And then 20 years later, the city hall wanted the land back. But it was not them to have back, because it belongs to the state. So we can pretend they started now and we are talking about a two-year struggle, but it's not true. It's just something that was in the plan of the mayor, even before he was a mayor. And these people was just on the way. They were just on the way.
For more, I've got John Bithrie on the line now from Rio. Hi, John. How are you?
Hello, Lizzie. I'm very well, thanks.
What happens now to the people who were living in this favela?
Well, most of them, as you were hearing in the piece there, have left. But around 20 families have stuck it out through what they see as intimidation by the authorities to leave the land. They are now being allowed to stay. Their existing homes inside the perimeter of the Olympic Park are going to be demolished. But work has already begun to build new homes for them. Just a few metres away, I saw the foundations for those homes when I was down there. The new settlement is going to be urbanised. That means it'll be sort of lifted from shanty town level. There'll be a proper access road, new power lines, other utilities. Plus, they're going to get a new sports field and cultural centre. That's the promise. And the mayor of Rio says that a new school may be built there, using, in fact, part of one of the arenas being used for Olympic events.
All of this is happening, you know, in the backdrop of a government crisis and a recession. Is it accurate to say that a lot of these long-standing tensions between rich and poor, are they being exacerbated by the terrible economic state Brazil is in?
Sure, to a degree, yes. I think the Olympics has very much focused minds on the differences between rich and poor, particularly here in Rio, where they are so great, where you have the middle classes enjoying life down in the wealthier suburbs, where I am in Ipanema, in Leblon, along in Copacabana, enjoying the beaches, and then higher up on the hills, on the hillsides, the shanty towns, the favelas, where life is very much harder. And a lot of people in these favelas think that with the spending going on in the Olympics, a lot of the pacification programs that have been going on, so work to reduce the violence, to improve life in these favelas, a lot of that money has been diverted and a lot of this work has gone. So, yes, I think a lot of that is being talked about at the moment.
John Bithrie from our partners at the BBC in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Even though it is the weekend, I'm willing to bet that you can't entirely escape your work when you're not there. Because now we have email, texts, and programs like the messaging app Slack, where you can stay in constant and sometimes unrelenting touch with your colleagues. And that, perhaps predictably, has led to something we're calling Slacklash. That is, people and companies who've gotten overwhelmed by all this communication and are rebelling. To talk about all this, we brought in Susan Lamott. She founded Execuio HR, which is a workplace consulting company. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So we've seen a bunch of articles lately and people saying, I'm giving up Slack. I don't want to communicate this way anymore. It seems as if there's a rebellion against workplace, instant messaging. Why do you think this is happening?
I think the biggest reason it's happening is because there's so much noise now that's impeding us from getting actual work done. Years ago, there were only a few ways to communicate, phone and in person, and then we added email. Now we've got at least 10 categories of communication, and then all of these different tools within those categories. And that noise is making it really hard to figure out who to talk to, how to talk to them, and when.
Well, what have you seen about who prefers to communicate sort of which way and how?
So there's two real reasons, I think, that drive communication style. The first is what I would call sort of senior most or VIP communication. So at the end of the day, even if you like using a tool like chat or Slack or whatever it is, if your CEO or your senior most client doesn't want to talk or chat that way, you have to defer to their method of communication. So that drives one method of communication. The other is work style. What I see a lot is that depending on the type of worker you are, how you behave, how you like to get things done, that might drive your actual choice of communication method. So for example, I'm a very task-oriented person. I move very quickly. So I love talking to clients on instant message or to text them on my phone. Others prefer to marinate on things, take their time. So for them, sometimes email or even in-person conversations are better because they have time to think and prepare.
I went into this thinking that the differences would be generational or maybe based on industry, but that's not what you've seen?
Certainly, I think generations are driving the use of more popular technologies because certainly we know Gen Y, Gen Z, they're just more comfortable with technology than baby boomers or the silent generation are. But that doesn't mean that certain technologies are unique to those generations. In more traditional Fortune 500 companies, they're still deferring primarily to email, mostly because of cultural nuances and because that's what they're used to. And that's the behavior in the organization of how work gets done.
Okay, I want you to put on your consultant hat for a second, because in preparation for talking with you, my producer Eliza and I evaluated the different ways in which our team communicates. So we're half on the East Coast and half on the West Coast. And we Slack, we have Google Docs, email, we use WebEx, we have phone calls. How would you kind of address that if you came in to work with us?
Well, first, it's figuring out what your primary tasks are during the day. If you're a radio show producer, for example, speed and time are of the essence. So yeah. I'd look first at what are the things that are urgent that have to happen during the day, and what are the best communications for those urgent tasks. For other things, stories or series that you might be working on over time, where you're talking to a number of different guests, doing interviews to build something up, then you might want to look at communication tools that allow for tracking of information. With chat, for example, it's really hard to make sure everyone sees it. But with email or even online project management tools, it's a lot easier to track notes and then directly point people back to those things. So I always recommend you start with what kind of work do you do and what are the things that drive that work? Is it speed? Is it time? And how much time do you have to actually get it done?
Yeah. I also am curious about the fact that the way we communicate with our colleagues seems to be, at least in these modern applications, mimicking some of the ways we communicate with our friends, that it's more casual, that tools like Slack or others, you can embed GIFs and emojis. I wonder if we are blurring the lines between professional and personal and what that means.
My friend Jason Seiden runs a company called Brand Amper, has a great term he uses called pro-personal. And it is this idea that those lives are continuing to cross. And I think the responsibility of our organizations is to recognize the nature of our pro-personal lifestyles now and to put some guardrails around that. What's appropriate, what's not. There's this, I think, unique desire with company cultures to sort of be cool and have just a couple of core values and let employees decide what's right and what's wrong, what's appropriate, what's not. But in all of the workforce research we do at Exaquio, employees tell us all the time, and this is employees of all generations, that they actually want rules. They want guardrails because it's so much easier when the organization says it's not appropriate to send gifts in company communication than it is for them to tell their friends or colleagues that that's the case. So it really falls to organizational culture to say, hey, here's what we value, and here are some of the work rules or behaviors around those values. And that can kind of help ensure that we are still moving forward, but it still allows us to have some guardrails around how we do it.
So assuming, if we will, that public radio is going to be around in 5 years, how do you think I'm going to be communicating with my team in 5 years?
I think you'll be communicating primarily through your mobile device for your everyday work. Quick conversations that you want to have, whether it's getting approval for something, whether it's trying to schedule an interview. And then I think we will still see some form of email or a merge of email and chat. So companies like Slack that are managing these kinds of quote-unquote project management tools will be enabling more opportunities to actually track conversations.
Susan Lamott, founder of Exequio HR, thank you so much.
Thank you.
On this show, we've been airing chunks of the new Marketplace podcast, The Uncertain Hour, which looks at welfare and welfare reform 20 years later. It's hosted by my colleague Chrissy Clark. This week's episode of The Uncertain Hour focuses on what we talk about when we talk about welfare and where the welfare money goes. It's not always what you think. Here's Chrissy Clark.
All right, so we're going to talk about love style.
It's a Thursday night in Oklahoma City, and I'm in a crowded conference room.
Love styles, right?
At the front, there's a guy with a white goatee and a polo shirt.
Let me ask you something.
His name is Scott Roby, and he's pointing at a slide with the image of a big, colorful heart on it. The heart's divided up into different quadrants, labeled with different love styles.
There's do, be, give, encourage, talk, and touch. Those are the six different dimensions or love styles. And we all have all of these within us.
But Scott says in every person, one or two love styles really rise to the top. Like if you're a doer, actions are an expression of love.
Maybe cooking a meal, doing a chore of theirs that they typically do, doing a load of laundry. Oh, I said the L word, but yeah. You know, something like that.
The audience is leaning in now. People are nudging each other, giving knowing looks when their love style comes up.
Sensual touch, if it's really going to feed the love style and feed the relationship, it's not always about landing the plane, if you know what I mean. Right?
Scott's audience, mostly young or middle-aged professionals, are dressed in their business casual clothes, most headed to this room right after work. And everyone in here is either married or engaged. In fact, that's the whole reason why they're here. It's a free class called Forever for Real.
Go make your forever for real.
Open to any couple who lives in Oklahoma, a kind of marriage counseling 101 to help them improve their relationships and build strong marriages. And dance to a little Al Green. Draw pictures of what a modern marriage looks like.
We're drawing a bicycle to show all the different phases of a relationship.
At the break, over Chex Mix and pizza, I mingle with some of the couples.
I'm Trey Martin.
Trey works in biotech. His fiancée,
Lori Radford,
is a paralegal. They met online. They're getting married in April. Heard about this class at a bridal show. And as they've just discovered, they're quite compatible when it comes to love languages. Thank goodness.
Touch.
Bingo. Touch.
Well, that's nice to have the same language. Okay, so I should probably tell you what I'm doing here in this marriage class. I am actually newly married myself, and I think touch is probably one of my preferred love styles, too. Also, encouragement. But I was at this Forever for Real class in Oklahoma City for a different reason, to ask couples like Trey and Lori two questions. Okay, a question that is going to sound like it's out of left field, but there's a reason I'm asking it. How do you feel about government assistance and welfare in this country. Do we spend enough, too much, not enough? Lori did not skip a beat.
I think too much.
And you feel like too much, why?
Because I think that the people who receive it, a lot of those people don't try to go find jobs. A lot of them just sit at home and they're not looking to better themselves.
And then I ask the second question. What if I told you that this class is funded by the welfare program? Trey and Lori look at each other, and this kind of amused panic spreads over Trey's face.
Oh my God, we're on welfare. I never thought I'd be on welfare. Well, that's great.
Oklahoma is just one of many states across the country where, 20 years after welfare reform, tens of millions of welfare dollars are going to things that surprise even the people who are benefiting from them. And not just those people. Even policy wonks like Devon Douglas of the Oklahoma Policy Institute are surprised by how her state spends welfare money, or, as it's officially known, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, TANF.
When I bring this up, you know, in conversation with my friends, when I can't stop nerding out about my job, you know, there's kind of a quizzical look on their face, and they think, oh, is the government, like, doing a matchmaking service? Like, does TANF help Tinder? Like, how does this work exactly? People just don't think that TANF is about getting people married.
But for others in Oklahoma, this makes perfect sense.
At the most basic level, a two-income family was more likely to take people out of poverty than a one-income family.
Mary Myrick is the president of Public Strategies, the for-profit public relations firm that runs Oklahoma's marriage initiative. Since 2001, her company has received more than $70 million in welfare money to run these marriage classes. The whole idea took hold in Oklahoma in the late 90s, when a report was commissioned by the state to look at why Oklahoma had one of the lowest per capita incomes in the country. The report pointed to the state's high divorce and out-of-wedlock pregnancy rates as possible causes. Right around the same time, welfare reform was kicking in, and the new system of block grants that gave states a lot of flexibility in terms of how they could use federal welfare dollars. Here's Kendi Cox, who also works at Public Strategies.
And so our governor at the time met with our Department of Human Services and said, why don't we use a very small portion of that money to try some innovative things to strengthen families as a way to say, you know, we spend in government so much time, so many resources dealing with the fallout of the family. Perhaps we should do some things on the prevention side.
And the Oklahoma Marriage Initiative was born. Some classes target low-income people, but most are open to everyone, rich, poor, and in between.
We're also providing an opportunity for anybody in the state of Oklahoma to access services that really can bolster not only their relationship, but their ability to stay self-sufficient and avoid poverty if they are, you know, middle-income people.
But the fact that all of these programs are funded by welfare dollars has become a growing concern to state lawmakers in Oklahoma, Democrats and Republicans, because while the money's going to lots of families who don't consider themselves especially needy, the state is also full of families who are, by any measure, very needy, but aren't getting any cash welfare at all. In Oklahoma, just 7 out of every 100 families living in poverty receive cash assistance.
I want to dig into those numbers a little bit now with Chrissy Clark and with Slate senior economics correspondent Jordan Weissman. Slate and Marketplace are collaborating here. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
Chrissy, were you surprised by what you found in Oklahoma?
Yes, is the short answer. Yeah, and, you know, amazingly, even some of the state legislators who I talked to in Oklahoma were surprised by how the money does and doesn't get spent in Oklahoma, the TANF block grant money. And that's the crazy thing. It's like the irony of when we turned this program into a block grant was to give more control over to states.
But no one is necessarily keeping track. In Oklahoma's case, it's pretty much just an executive branch and administrative decision how this welfare money, these federal welfare dollars, get spent. And there's not a lot of legislative involvement. So I think a lot of people in Oklahoma were like, oh, okay, this is where the money goes. And these are the people who are not getting it that we thought were getting it.
Jordan, how does that experience in Oklahoma mirror national welfare spending?
It's pretty similar to what we've seen in a bunch of different states. I mean, the thing about the welfare system now is we don't really have a single welfare system. We have 50 different ones because of block granting. But if you look nationwide, right, about 20% of the welfare budget nationwide goes to what's called other non-assistance, according to the Center for Budget Policy and Priorities. And that's just a grab bag of things that include, you know, expenses like the adoption system or the, you know, child protective services systems in some states. You know, in Georgia, famously, they spend a massive amount of their budget on it. In Arizona, for instance, they spend more than half on, you know, their essentially child services, and that, instead of what we think of as, you know, welfare, basic cash assistance.
Chrissy, one of the ideas behind block grants was, gee, a local government or state government might know better what its citizens need. Do block grants work?
Yeah, I think that was really the idea that, you know, states could take this money and really customize what their local economy, what the families in that local economy needed. But especially in budget crunches, which Oklahoma is in right now, I think they're $1 billion short. There's lots of states that are facing this. This block grant money becomes what one woman I talked to called the pretty money. There's not a lot of strings attached to it. And so the original intent of that money, which was to help struggling families with children meet their basic needs, to provide a safety net for people who've hit really hard times, to help get them back into the job market, that intent has kind of been lost as all of these other interests say, this is free federal money that we can use. Let's put it towards this project or that. And as worthy as that project might be, it's not what we think the money would be going to, given that it's called welfare.
Jordan, you wrote that this is a zombie system and not a bridge from poverty to work, which was the goal. What happened to that goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, states were given very, very loose guidelines about how they could use the money. TANF was created in the middle of the 90s, you know, tech boom and the kind of surging economy where employment was easy to find. And for a variety of reasons, the welfare rolls fell without the states having to do quite so much work to help people find jobs. And, you know, they also kind of reduced their rolls by keeping people from enrolling in the first place or qualifying in the first place. And slowly over time, money got put to other, or not even that slowly, but over time, money got put to other uses. Things like, you know, these marriage programs in Oklahoma, or, you know, funding child welfare systems that otherwise have been grossly underfunded in some states. And legislators have kind of treated the program as a slush fund. And that is hard to square with using that money to get people into work.
Jordan Weissman from Slate, Chrissy Clark from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much, Lizzie.
Thanks so much.
No matter who you are, you probably had a bad day at the office that changed your perspective. Or maybe you made an impulse purchase you really, really wish you could take back. This week, musician Esperanza Spalding sat down with our producer Raghu Manavalan to take the Marketplace quiz. That's our questionnaire based on experiences with work and money.
My name is Esperanza Spalding, and I don't like to describe myself. I make sounds and art.
What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows?
I think the hardest part, what's coming to mind right now, is learning that you can't really trust the opinion of other people about the work that you're doing. You know, if your boss in the office says, like, this is not a good article, I need you to rewrite it for this reason, and then you rewrite it and you see that it's better, you go, oh, okay, I'm going to trust my boss, and also I'm accountable to him. But in music or in art, you have to find this compass in a way that's sort of insulated from other people's feedback and hold yourself accountable to a standard that you believe in. That sounds really nice, but it's actually very, 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 very challenging to keep in touch with that compass when a lot of other people are giving you opinions, good and bad, about the work that you're doing. I'm not
lacking love, no. What is something you bought that you now completely regret buying?
Oh my God. So many things. I feel like everything that I've ever ordered on Amazon, I don't understand. I love Amazon, but I never use what I buy. It's crazy. I feel like half my bookshelf is just stuff that I one-clicked and never read and will never read. The world so strong,
it stops the world in my heart spinning. When did you realize music could be an actual paying career?
Ooh, very early, actually. Very, very early, when I was probably 15. I had a trio with a friend, with two friends, obviously. I didn't sing yet. So we built ourselves as a trio, and then we realized, wait a minute, we could charge as four people, but we're only three, because I could. What if I learned how to sing?
Yeah, true.
And that's when it all came into focus that you could do things to make more money playing music.
That's awesome.
Yeah, there were a lot of gigs at that time. When I was very young in Portland, and I started gigging a lot. I never understood that you could do it for your whole life. It seemed so novel, you know. I always had like 9-to-5 jobs when I was younger and older. And at one point, my boss pulled me aside and he said, you know, you can't keep missing work to do gigs. You're going to have to choose. And then I realized, like, oh, wow, I have been earning money doing gigs. Maybe I can actually pay my rent this way. And the rest is unfolding. Judge the whole story of love, same old play. I'm getting tired of no more acting these predictable roles, just a sleeper, unconditional love.
What was your first job?
My first job, I worked at a place called People's Food Co-op. That was my first real job. I fell asleep as my boss was telling me things because I had just discovered that I didn't live at home anymore, and I could stay out late and get in trouble, and nobody would be there to notice when I came home. So I was doing that pretty much every night, and I'd go in to have meetings with my boss, Louise, and then I'd wake up to her yelling at me, saying, like, are you listening, Esperanza? And I would have fallen asleep. I was very irresponsible, and I'm really sorry, Louise, for being such a horrible employee. And I won't even tell you about working for the Portland Parks and Recreation for the No Ivy League. That was my second job.
Too cool.
I really am from Oregon. I don't know if you noticed this, but I'm from Oregon. If some
magic should find me. What is your most prized possession?
Right now, my most prized possession is the journal or the notebook in which I have been brainstorming and devising the next iteration of my project.
Mm-hmm.
If I lost that notebook, it would really hurt and sting because everything's in there. It's just real, it's raw. It's like a field journal because it's with me all the time in case I think of something at the moment that seems brilliant. And if I lost that possession, it would hurt a lot. Judas, you
know the lonesome road. Last question. What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
Ooh, a couple things. One, no matter how daunting it seems, make sure you can repeat everything in the contract in your own language. Make sure that you can say each paragraph again in your own layman's terms. I would make sure that you can say that to a lawyer who then can tell you yes or no. You did understand that or you didn't understand that. I would also, I wish somebody would have said, no, you can do it by yourself first before you reach out for support or before you depend on other people for their support making your visions come to fruition. I'm learning that now, and I think I would have done some projects much better if I would have had that mode going into the creation of it. But you have a mind.
Esperanza Spalding's latest album, Emily's De-Evolution, is out now. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we want more of your stories about how to travel with kids and how to save money when you do it. Come share your tips. Let us know by visiting marketplace.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, with help this week from Golda Arthur. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Noren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. And Deborah Clark is our vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.